one man over another man, but of one people over another people. Of the right of succession. Of all these forms of government, the matter being mortal, so that not only monarchs but also whole assemblies die, it is necessary for the conservation of the peace of men that as there was order taken for an artificial man, so there be order also taken for an artificial eternity of life, without which men that are governed by an assembly should return into the condition of war in every age, and they that are governed by one man as soon as their governor dieth. This artificial eternity is that which men call the right of succession. There is no perfect form of government where the disposing of the succession is not in the present sovereign. For if it be in any other particular man or private assembly, it is in a person subject and may be assumed by the sovereign at his pleasure, and consequently the right is in himself. And if it be in no particular man but left to a new choice, then is the commonwealth dissolved, and the right is in him that can get it, contrary to the intention of them that did institute the commonwealth for their perpetual and not temporary security. In a democracy the whole assembly cannot fail unless the multitude that are to be governed fail, and therefore questions of the right of succession have in that form of government no place at all. In an aristocracy, when any of the assembly dieth, the election of another into his room belongeth to the assembly, as the sovereign, to whom belongeth the choosing of all councillors and officers. For that which the representative doth as actor, every one of the subjects doth as author. And though the sovereign assembly may give power to others to elect new men for supply of their court, yet it is still by their authority that the election is made, and by the same it may, when the public shall require it, be recalled. The present monarch hath right to dispose of the succession. The greatest difficulty about the right of succession is in monarchy. And the difficulty ariseth from this, that at first sight it is not manifest who is to appoint the successor, nor many times who it is whom he hath appointed. For in both these cases there is required a more exact ratiocination than every man is accustomed to use. As to the question, who shall appoint the successor of a monarch that hath the sovereign authority, that is to say, who shall determine of the right of inheritance, for elective kings and princes have not the sovereign power in propriety, but in use only, we are to consider that either he that is in possession has right to dispose of the succession, or else that right is again in the dissolved multitude. For the death of him that hath the sovereign power in propriety leaves the multitude without any sovereign at all, that is, without any representative in whom they should be united, and be capable of doing any one action at all, and therefore they are incapable of election of any new monarch, every man having equal right to submit himself to such as he thinks best able to protect him, or if he can, protect himself by his own sword, which is a return to confusion, and to the condition of a war of every man against every man, contrary to the end for which monarchy had its first institution. Therefore it is manifest that by the institution of monarchy the disposing of the successor is always left to the judgment and will of the present possessor. And for the question which may arise sometimes, who it is that the monarch in possession hath designed to the succession and inheritance of his power, it is determined by his express words and testament, or by other tacit signs sufficient. Succession passeth by express words. By express words or testament, when it is declared by him in his lifetime, viva voce, or by writing, as the first emperors of Rome declared who should be their heirs. For the word heir does not of itself imply the children or nearest kindred of a man, but whomsoever a man shall any way declare, he would have to succeed him in his estate. If, therefore, a monarch declare expressly that such a man shall be his heir, either by word or writing, then is that man immediately after the decease of his predecessor invested in the right of being monarch, or by not controlling a custom. But where testament and express words are wanting, other natural signs of the will are to be followed. whereof the one is custom, and therefore where the custom is that the next of kindred absolutely succeedeth, there also the next of kindred hath right to the succession. For that, if the will of him that was in possession had been otherwise, he might easily have declared the same in his lifetime. And likewise, where the custom is that the next of the male kindred succeedeth, there also the right of succession is in the next of the kindred male, for the same reason. And so it is if the custom were to advance the female. For whatsoever custom a man by a word control, and does not, it is a natural sign he would have that custom stand. Or by presumption of natural affection. But where neither custom nor testament hath preceded, there it is to be understood first that a monarch's will is that the government remain monarchical, because he hath approved that government in himself. Secondly, that a child of his own, male or female, be preferred before any other, because men are presumed to be more inclined by nature to advance their own children than the children of other men, and of their own rather a male than a female, because men are naturally fitter than women for actions of labour and danger. Thirdly, where his own issue faileth, rather a brother than a stranger, and so still the nearer in blood rather than the more remote, because it is always presumed that the nearer of kin is the nearer in affection, and it is evident that a man receives always by reflection the most honour from the greatness of his nearest kindred. To dispose of the succession, though to a king of another nation, not unlawful. But if it be lawful for a monarch to dispose of the succession by words of contract or testament, men may perhaps object a great inconvenience, for he may sell or give his right of governing to a stranger, which because strangers, that is, men not used to live under the same government, nor speaking the same language, do commonly undervalue one another, may turn to the oppression of his subjects, which is indeed a great inconvenience, but it proceedeth not necessarily from the subjection to a stranger's government, but from the unskilfulness of the governors, ignorant of the true rules of politics. And therefore the Romans, when they had subdued many nations to make their government digestible, were wont to take away that grievance as much as they thought necessary, by giving sometimes to whole nations, and sometimes to principal men of every nation they conquered, not only the privileges, but also the name of Romans, and took many of them into the Senate and offices of charge, even in the Roman city. And this was it our most wise king, King James, aimed at in endeavouring the union of his two realms of England and Scotland, which, if he could have obtained, had in all likelihood prevented the civil wars, which make both those kingdoms at this present miserable. It is not therefore any injury to the people for a monarch to dispose of the succession by will, though by the fault of many princes it hath been sometimes found inconvenient. Of the lawfulness of it, this also is an argument, that whatsoever inconvenience can arrive by giving a kingdom to a stranger, may arrive also by so marrying with strangers as the right of succession may descend upon them. Yet this by all men is accounted lawful. Chapter 20. Of Dominion Paternal and Despotical. A Commonwealth by Acquisition. A commonwealth by acquisition is that where the sovereign power is acquired by force, and it is acquired by force when men singly or many together by plurality of voices, for fear of death or bonds, do authorize all the actions of that man or assembly that hath their lives and liberty in his power. Wherein different from a commonwealth by institution. And this kind of dominion or sovereignty differeth from sovereignty by institution only in this, that men who choose their sovereign do it for fear of one another, and not of him whom they institute, but in this case they subject themselves to him they are afraid of. In both cases they do it for fear, which is to be noted by them that hold all such covenants as proceed from fear of death or violence void, which if it were true, no man in any kind of commonwealth could be obliged to obedience. It is true that in a commonwealth once instituted or acquired, promises proceeding from fear of death or violence are no covenants, nor obliging when the thing promised is contrary to the laws. But the reason is not because it was made upon fear, but because he that promiseth hath no right in the thing promised. Also, when he may lawfully perform and doth not, it is not the invalidity of the covenant that absolveth him, but the sentence of the sovereign. Otherwise, whensoever a man lawfully promiseth, he unlawfully breaketh, but when the sovereign, who is the actor, acquitteth him, then he is acquitted by him that extorted the promise, as by the author of such absolution. The rights of sovereignty, the same in both. But the rights and consequences of sovereignty are the same in both. His power cannot, without his consent, be transferred to another. He cannot forfeit it. He cannot be accused by any of his subjects of injury. He cannot be punished by them. He is judge of what is necessary for peace, and judge of doctrines. He is sole legislator, and supreme judge of controversies, and of the times and occasions of war and peace. To him it belongeth to choose magistrates, counsellors, commanders, and all other officers and ministers, and to determine of rewards and punishments, honour and order. The reasons whereof are the same which are alleged in the precedent chapter, for the same rights and consequences of sovereignty by institution. Dominion paternal how attained, not by generation, but by contract. Dominion is acquired two ways, by generation and by conquest. The right of dominion by generation is that which the parent hath over his children, and is called paternal, and is not so derived from the generation, as if therefore the parent had dominion over his child because he begat him, but from the child's consent, either express or by other sufficient arguments declared. For as to the generation, God hath ordained to man a helper, and there be always two that are equally parents. The dominion, therefore, over the child should belong equally to both, and he be equally subject to both, which is impossible, for no man can obey two masters. And whereas some have attributed the dominion to the man only, as being of the more excellent sex, they misreckon in it. For there is not always that difference of strength or prudence between the man and the woman, as that the right can be determined without war. In commonwealths, this controversy is decided by the civil law, and for the most part, but not always, the sentence is in favour of the father, because for the most part commonwealths have been erected by the fathers, not by the mothers of families. But the question lieth now in the state of mere nature, where there are, suppose, no laws of matrimony, no laws for the education of children, but the law of nature and the natural inclination of the sexes, one to another and to their children. In this condition of mere nature, either the parents between themselves dispose of the dominion over the child by contract, or do not dispose thereof at all. If they dispose thereof, the right passeth according to the contract. We find in history that the Amazons contracted with the men of the neighbouring countries, to whom they had recourse for issue, that the issue male should be sent back, but the female remain with themselves, so that the dominion of the females was in the mother. Or education. If there be no contract, the dominion is in the mother, for in the condition of mere nature, where there are no matrimonial laws, it cannot be known who is the father, unless it be declared by the mother, and therefore the right of dominion over the child dependeth on her will, and is consequently hers. Again, seeing the infant is first in the power of the mother, so as she may either nourish or expose it, if she nourish it, it oweth its life to the mother, and is therefore obliged to obey her rather than any other, and by consequence the dominion over it is hers. But if she expose it, and another find and nourish it, the dominion is in him that nourisheth it. For it ought to obey him by whom it is preserved, because preservation of life being the end, for which one man becomes subject to another, every man is supposed to promise obedience to him in whose power it is to save or destroy him. Or precedent subjection of one of the parents to the other. If the mother be the father's subject, the child is in the father's power. And if the father be the mother's subject, as when a sovereign queen marrieth one of her subjects, the child is subject to the mother, because the father also is her subject. If a man and woman, monarchs of two several kingdoms, have a child, and contract concerning who shall have the dominion of him, the right of the dominion passeth by the contract. If they contract not, the dominion followeth the dominion of the place of his residence, for the sovereign of each country hath dominion over all that reside therein. He that hath the dominion over the child hath dominion also over the children of the child, and over their children's children. For he that hath dominion over the person of a man hath dominion over all that is his, without which dominion were but a title without the effect. The right of succession followeth the rules of the right of possession. The right of succession to paternal dominion proceedeth in the same manner as doth the right of succession of monarchy, of which I have already sufficiently spoken in the precedent chapter. Despotical dominion how attained? Dominion acquired by conquest or victory in war is that which some writers call despotical, which signifieth a lord or master, and is the dominion of the master over his servant. And this dominion is then acquired to the victor, when the vanquished, to avoid the present stroke of death, covenanteth either in express words or by other sufficient signs of the will, that so long as his life and the liberty of his body is allowed him, the victor shall have the use thereof at his pleasure. And after such covenant made, the vanquished is a servant, and not before. For by the word servant, whether it be derived from servir, to serve, or from servare, to save, which I leave to grammarians to dispute, is not meant a captive, which is kept in prison, or bonds, till the owner of him that took him, or brought him of one that did, shall consider what to do with him. For such men, commonly called slaves, have no obligation at all, but may break their bonds or the prison, and kill or carry away captive their master, justly. But one that being taken hath corporal liberty allowed him, and upon promise not to run away, nor to do violence to his master, is trusted by him. Not by the victory, but by the consent of the vanquished. It is not therefore the victory that giveth the right of dominion over the vanquished, but his own covenant. Nor is he obliged because he is conquered, that is to say, beaten and taken or put to flight, but because he cometh in and submitteth to the victor. Nor is the victor obliged by an enemy's rendering himself without promise of life to spare him for this his yielding to discretion, which obliges not the victor longer than in his own discretion he shall think fit. And that which men do when they demand, as it is now called, quarter, is to evade the present fury of the victor by submission and to compound for their life with ransom or service, and therefore he that hath quarter hath not his life given, but deferred till farther deliberation, for it is not a yielding on condition of life, but to discretion. And then only is his life in security and his service due, when the victor hath trusted him with his corporal liberty. For slaves that work in prisons or fetters do it not of duty, but to avoid the cruelty of their taskmasters. The master of the servant is master also of all he hath, and may exact the use thereof, that is to say, of his goods, of his labour, of his servants, and of his children, as often as he shall think fit. For he holdeth his life of his master by the covenant of obedience, that is, of owning and authorising whatsoever the master shall do. And in case the master, if he refuse, kill him or cast him into bonds, or otherwise punish him for his disobedience, he is himself the author of the same, and cannot accuse him of injury. In sum, the rights and consequences of both paternal and despotical dominion are the very same with those of a sovereign by institution, and for the same reasons, which reasons are set down in the precedent chapter. So that for a man that is monarch of divers nations, whereof he hath in one the sovereignty by institution of the people assembled, and in another by conquest, that is, by the submission of each particular, to avoid death or bonds, to demand of one nation more than of the other, from the title of conquest, as being a conquered nation, is an act of ignorance of the rights of sovereignty. For the sovereign is absolute over both alike, or else there is no sovereignty at all, and so every man may lawfully protect himself if he can with his own sword, which is the condition of war. difference between a family and a kingdom. By this it appears that a great family, if it be not part of some commonwealth, is of itself, as to the rights of sovereignty, a little monarchy. Whether that family consist of a man and his children, or of a man and his servants, or of a man and his children and servants together, wherein the father or master is the sovereign. But yet a family is not properly a commonwealth, unless it be that power by its own number or by other opportunities, as not to be subdued without the hazard of war. For where a number of men are manifestly too weak to defend themselves united, every one may use his own reason in time of danger to save his own life, either by flight or by submission to the enemy, as he shall think best. In the same manner as a very small company of soldiers, surprised by an army, may cast down their arms and demand quarter or run away, rather than be put to the sword. And thus much shall suffice concerning what I find by speculation and deduction of sovereign rights from the nature, need, and designs of men in erecting of commonwealths and putting themselves under monarchs or assemblies entrusted with power enough for their protection. The rights of monarchy from Scripture. Let us now consider what the Scripture teacheth in the same point. To Moses the children of Israel say thus, Speak thou to us, and we will hear thee, but let not God speak to us, lest we die. Exodus 20:19. This is absolute obedience to Moses. Concerning the right of kings, God himself by the mouth of Samuel saith, 1 Samuel 8:11-12, etc., This shall be the right of the king you will have to reign over you. He shall take your sons and set them to drive his chariots, and to be his horsemen, and to run before his chariots, and gather in his harvest, and to make his engines of war, and instruments of his chariots, and shall take your daughters to make perfumes, to be his cooks and bakers. He shall take your fields, your vineyards, and your olive yards, and give them to his servants. He shall take the tithe of your corn and wine, and give it to the men of his chamber, and to his other servants. He shall take your manservants and your maidservants, and the choice of your youth, and employ them in his business. He shall take the tithe of your flocks, and you shall be his servants. This is absolute power, and summed up in the last words, you shall be his servants. Again, when the people heard what power their king was to have, yet then consented thereto, and say thus, verse 19, We will be as all other nations, and our king shall judge our causes, and go before us to conduct our wars. Here is confirmed the right that sovereigns have both to the militia and to all judicature, in which is contained as absolute power as one man can possibly transfer to another. Again, the prayer of King Solomon to God was this, 1 Kings 3:9, Give to thy servant understanding, to judge thy people, and to discern between good and evil. It belongeth therefore to the sovereign to be judge and to prescribe the rules of discerning good and evil, which rules are laws, and therefore in him is the legislative power. Saul sought the life of David, yet when it was in his power to slay Saul and his servants would have done it, David forbade them, saying, 1 Samuel 24:6, God forbid I should do such an act against my Lord, the anointed of God. For obedience of servants, St. Paul saith, Colossians 3:22, Servants, obey your masters in all things, and Colossians 3:20, Children, obey your parents in all things. There is simple obedience in those that are subject to paternal or despotical dominion. Again, Matthew 23:2-3, The scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' chair, and therefore all that they shall bid you observe, that observe and do. There again is simple obedience. And St. Paul, Titus 3:2, Warn them that they subject themselves to princes and to those that are in authority and obey them. This obedience is also simple. Lastly, our Saviour himself acknowledges that men ought to pay such taxes as are by kings imposed, where he says, Give to Caesar that which is Caesar's, and paid such taxes himself, and that the king's word is sufficient to take anything from any subject when there is need, and that the king is judge of that need, for he himself, as king of the Jews, commanded his disciples to take the ass and ass's colt to carry him into Jerusalem, saying, Matthew 21:2-3, Go into the village over against you, and you shall find a she-ass tied, and her colt with her. Untie them, and bring them to me. And if any man ask you what you mean by it, say, The Lord hath need of them, and they will let them go. They will not ask whether his necessity be a sufficient title, nor whether he be judge of that necessity, but acquiesce in the will of the Lord. To these places may be added also that of Genesis 3:5, Ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil, and, verse 11, Who told thee that thou wast naked? Hast thou eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee thou shouldest not eat? For the cognizance or judicature of good and evil, being forbidden by the name of the fruit of the tree of knowledge as a trial of Adam's obedience, the devil to inflame the ambition of the woman, to whom that fruit already seemed beautiful, told her that by tasting it they should be as gods, knowing good and evil. Whereupon, having both eaten, they did indeed take upon them God's office, which is judicature of good and evil, but acquired no new ability to distinguish between them aright. And whereas it is said that having eaten they saw they were naked, no man hath so interpreted that place as if they had been formerly blind and saw not their own skins. The meaning is plain, that it was then they first judged their nakedness, wherein it was God's will to create them to be uncomely, and by being ashamed did tacitly censure God himself. And thereupon God saith, Hast thou eaten, etc., as if he should say, Dost thou, that owest me obedience, take upon thee to judge of my commandments? Whereby it is clearly, though allegorically, signified that the commands of them that have the right to command are not by their subjects to be censured nor disputed. Sovereign power ought in all commonwealths to be absolute. So that it appeareth plainly to my understanding, both from reason and scripture, that the sovereign power, whether placed in one man, as in monarchy, or in one assembly of men, as in popular and aristocratical commonwealths, is as great as possibly men can be imagined to make it. And though of so unlimited a power, men may fancy many evil consequences, yet the consequences of the want of it, which is perpetual war of every man against his neighbour, are much worse. The condition of man in this life shall never be without inconveniences, but there happeneth in no commonwealth any great inconvenience but what proceeds from the subject's disobedience and breach of those covenants from which the commonwealth hath its being. And whosoever thinking sovereign power too great will seek to make it less, must subject himself to the power that can limit it, that is to say, to a greater. The greatest objection is that of the practice, when men ask where and when such power has by subjects been acknowledged. But one may ask them again, when or where has there been a kingdom long free from sedition and civil war? In those nations whose commonwealths have been long lived, and not been destroyed but by foreign war, the subjects never did dispute of the sovereign power. But howsoever, an argument from the practice of men that have not sifted to the bottom, and with exact reason weighed the causes and nature of commonwealths, and suffer daily those miseries that proceed from the ignorance thereof, is invalid. For though in all places of the world men should lay the foundation of their houses on the sand, it could not thence be inferred that so it ought to be. The skill of making and maintaining commonwealths consisteth in certain rules, as doth arithmetic and geometry, not as tennis play on practice only, which rules neither poor men have the leisure, nor men that have had the leisure have hitherto had the curiosity or the method to find out. Chapter 21. Of the Liberty of Subjects. Liberty what? Liberty or freedom signifieth properly the absence of opposition. By opposition I mean external impediments of motion, and may be applied no less to irrational and inanimate creatures than to rational. For whatsoever is so tied or environed as it cannot move but within a certain space, which space is determined by the opposition of some external body, we say it hath not liberty to go further. And so of all living creatures, whilst they are imprisoned or restrained with walls or chains, and of the water whilst it is kept in by banks or vessels that otherwise would spread itself into a larger space, we used to say they are not at liberty to move in such manner as without those external impediments they would. But when the impediment of motion is in the constitution of the thing itself, we use not to say it wants the liberty, but the power to move, as when a stone lieth still or a man is fastened to his bed by sickness. What it is to be free. And according to this proper and generally received meaning of the word, a freeman is he that in those things which by his strength and wit he is able to do, is not hindered to do what he has a will to. But when the words free and liberty are applied to anything but bodies, they are abused. For that which is not subject to motion is not subject to impediment, and therefore, when it is said, for example, the way is free, no liberty of the way is signified, but of those that walk in it without stop. And when we say a gift is free, there is not meant any liberty of the gift, but of the giver, that was not bound by any law or covenant to give it. So when we speak freely, it is not the liberty of voice or pronunciation, but of the man, whom no law hath obliged to speak otherwise than he did. Lastly, from the use of the word free will, no liberty can be inferred of the will, desire, or inclination, but the liberty of the man, which consisteth in this, that he finds no stop in doing what he has the will, desire, or inclination to do. Fear and liberty consistent. Fear and liberty are consistent, as when a man throweth his goods into the sea for fear the ship should sink. He doth it nevertheless very willingly, and may refuse to do it if he will. It is therefore the action of one that was free, so a man sometimes pays his debt, only for fear of imprisonment, which because nobody hindered him from detaining, was the action of a man at liberty. And generally all actions which men do in commonwealths, for fear of the law, are actions which the doers had liberty to omit. Liberty and necessity consistent. Liberty and necessity are consistent, as in the water that hath not only liberty, but a necessity of descending by the channel. So, likewise, in the actions which men voluntarily do, which, because they proceed from their will, proceed from liberty, and yet, because every act of man's will and every desire and inclination proceedeth from some cause, and that from another cause, in a continual chain, whose first link is in the hand of God, the first of all causes, proceed from necessity. So that to him that could see the connection of those causes, the necessity of all men's voluntary actions would appear manifest. And therefore God, that seeth and disposeth all things, seeth also that the liberty of man in doing what he will is accompanied with the necessity of doing that which God will, and no more nor less. For though men may do many things which God does not command, nor is therefore author of them, yet they can have no passion nor appetite to anything, of which appetite God's will is not the cause. And did not his will assure the necessity of man's will, and consequently of all that on man's will dependeth, the liberty of men would be a contradiction and impediment to the omnipotence and liberty of God. And this shall suffice as to the matter in hand of that natural liberty which only is properly called liberty. Artificial bonds or covenants. But as men, for the attaining of peace and conservation of themselves thereby, have made an artificial man which we call a commonwealth, so also have they made artificial chains called civil laws, which they themselves by mutual covenants have fastened at one end to the lips of that man or assembly to whom they have given the sovereign power, and at the other end to their own ears. These bonds, in their own nature but weak, may nevertheless be made to hold by the danger, though not by the difficulty, of breaking them. Liberty of subjects consisteth in liberty from covenants. In relation to these bonds only it is that I am to speak now of the liberty of subjects, for seeing there is no commonwealth in the world wherein there be rules enough set down for the regulating of all the actions and words of men, as being a thing impossible, it followeth necessarily that in all kinds of actions by the laws pretermitted, men have the liberty of doing what their own reasons shall suggest for the most profitable to themselves. For if we take liberty in the proper sense for corporal liberty, that is to say, freedom from chains and prison, it were very absurd for men to clamour as they do for the liberty they so manifestly enjoy. Again, if we take liberty for an exemption from laws, it is no less absurd for men to demand as they do that liberty by which all other men may be masters of their lives. And yet, as absurd as it is, this is it they demand, not knowing that the laws are of no power to protect them without a sword in the hands of a man or men to cause those laws to be put in execution. The liberty of a subject lieth therefore only in those things which in regulating their actions the sovereign hath pretermitted, such as is the liberty to buy and sell and otherwise contract with one another, to choose their own abode, their own diet, their own trade of life, and institute their children as they themselves think fit, and the like. Liberty of the subject, consistent with the unlimited power of the sovereign. Nevertheless, we are not to understand that by such liberty the sovereign power of life and death is either abolished or limited. For it has been already shown that nothing the sovereign representative can do to a subject, on what pretence soever, can properly be called injustice or injury, because every subject is author of every act the sovereign doth, so that he never wanteth right to anything otherwise than as he himself is the subject of God, and bound thereby to observe the laws of nature. And therefore it may, and doth often happen in commonwealths, that a subject may be put to death by the command of the sovereign power, and yet neither do the other wrong, as when Jephthah caused his daughter to be sacrificed, in which and the like cases he that so dieth had liberty to do the action, for which he is, nevertheless, without injury put to death. And the same holdeth also in a sovereign prince, that putteth to death an innocent subject. For though the action be against the law of nature, as being contrary to equity, as was the killing of Uriah by David, yet it was not an injury to Uriah, but to God. Not to Uriah, because the right to do what he pleased was given him by Uriah himself, and yet to God, because David was God's subject, and prohibited all iniquity by the law of nature, which distinction David himself, when he repented the fact, evidently confirmed, saying, "To thee only have I sinned." In the same manner, the people of Athens, when they banished the most potent of their commonwealth for 10 years, thought they committed no injustice, and yet they never questioned what crime he had done, but what hurt he would do. Nay, they commanded the banishment of they knew not whom, and every citizen bringing his oyster shell into the marketplace, written with the name of him he desired should be banished, without actually accusing him, sometimes banished an Aristides for his reputation of justice, and sometimes a scurrilous jester, as Hyperbolus, to make a jest of it. And yet a man cannot say the sovereign people of Athens wanted right to banish them, or an Athenian the liberty to jest or to be just. The liberty which writers praise is the liberty of sovereigns, not of private men. The liberty whereof there is so frequent and honourable mention in the histories and philosophy of the ancient Greeks and Romans and in the writings and discourse of those that from them have received all their learning in the politics is not the liberty of particular men, but the liberty of the commonwealth, which is the same with that which every man then should have, if there were no civil laws nor commonwealth at all. And the effects of it also be the same, for as amongst masterless men there is perpetual war of every man against his neighbour, no inheritance to transmit to the son, nor to expect from the father, no propriety of goods or lands, no security, but a full and absolute liberty in every particular man. So in states and commonwealths, not dependent on one another, every commonwealth, not every man, has an absolute liberty to do what it shall judge, that is to say, what that man or assembly that representeth it shall judge most conducing to their benefit. But withal, they live in the condition of a perpetual war and upon the confines of battle, with their frontiers armed and cannons planted against their neighbours round about. The Athenians and Romans were free, that is, free commonwealths. Not that any particular men had the liberty to resist their own representative, but that their representative had the liberty to resist or invade other people. There is written on the turrets of the city of Lucca in great characters at this day the word libertas, yet no man can thence infer that a particular man has more liberty or immunity from the service of the commonwealth there than in Constantinople. Whether a commonwealth be monarchical or popular, the freedom is still the same. But it is an easy thing for men to be deceived by the specious name of liberty, and for want of judgment to distinguish, mistake that for their private inheritance and birthright, which is the right of the public only. And when the same error is confirmed by the authority of men in reputation for their writings on this subject, it is no wonder if it produce sedition and change of government. In these western parts of the world, we are made to receive our opinions concerning the institution and rights of commonwealths from Aristotle, Cicero, and other men, Greeks and Romans, that living under popular states derived those rights not from the principles of nature, but transcribed them into their books out of the practice of their own commonwealths, which were popular, as the grammarians describe the rules of language out of the practice of the time, or the rules of poetry out of the poems of Homer and Virgil. And because the Athenians were taught, to keep them from desire of changing their government, that they were freemen, and all that lived under monarchy were slaves, therefore Aristotle puts it down in his Politics, Book 6, Chapter 2, in democracy, liberty is to be supposed, for it is commonly held, that no man is free in any other government. And as Aristotle, so Cicero and other writers have grounded their civil doctrine on the opinions of the Romans, who were taught to hate monarchy, at first by them that having deposed their sovereign, shared amongst them the sovereignty of Rome, and afterwards by their successors. And by reading of these Greek and Latin authors, men from their childhood have gotten a habit, under a false show of liberty, of favouring tumults and of licentious controlling the actions of their sovereigns, and again of controlling those controllers, with the effusion of so much blood, as I think I may truly say, there was never anything so dearly bought as these western parts have bought the learning of the Greek and Latin tongues. Liberty of subjects, how to be measured. To come now to the particulars of the true liberty of a subject, that is to say, what are the things which, though commanded by the sovereign, he may nevertheless without injustice refuse to do, we are to consider what rights we pass away when we make a commonwealth, or, which is all one, what liberty we deny ourselves by owning all the actions, without exception, of the man or assembly we make our sovereign. For in the act of our submission consisteth both our obligation and our liberty, which must therefore be inferred by arguments taken from thence, there being no obligation on any man which ariseth not from some act of his own, for all men equally are by nature free. And because such arguments must either be drawn from the express words, I authorize all his actions, or from the intention of him that submitteth himself to his power, which intention is to be understood by the end for which he so submitteth, the obligation and liberty of the subject is to be derived either from those words or others equivalent, or else from the end of the institution of sovereignty, namely the peace of the subjects within themselves and their defence against a common enemy. subjects have liberty to defend their own bodies, even against them that lawfully invade them. First, therefore, seeing sovereignty by institution is by covenant of everyone to everyone, and sovereignty by acquisition by covenants of the vanquished to the victor, or child to the parent, it is manifest that every subject has liberty in all those things, the right whereof cannot by covenant be transferred. I have shown before in the 14th chapter that covenants not to defend a man's own body are void, therefore are not bound to hurt themselves. If the sovereign command a man, though justly condemned, to kill, wound, or maim himself, or not to resist those that assault him, or to abstain from the use of food, air, medicine, or any other thing without which he cannot live, yet hath that man the liberty to disobey. If a man be interrogated by the sovereign or his authority concerning a crime done by himself, he is not bound without assurance of pardon to confess it, because no man, as I have shown in the same chapter, can be obliged by covenant to accuse himself. Again, the consent of a subject to sovereign power is contained in these words, I authorize or take upon me all his actions, in which there is no restriction at all of his own former natural liberty, for by allowing him to kill me, I am not bound to kill myself when he commands me. It is one thing to say, kill me or my fellow, if you please, another thing to say, I will kill myself or my fellow. It followeth, therefore, that no man is bound by these words themselves, either to kill himself or any other man, and consequently that the obligation a man may sometimes have upon the command of the sovereign to execute any dangerous or dishonourable office dependeth not on the words of our submission, but on the intention, which is to be understood by the end thereof. When, therefore, our refusal to obey frustrates the end for which the sovereignty was ordained, then there is no liberty to refuse, otherwise there is. Nor to warfare, unless they voluntarily undertake it. Upon this ground, a man that is commanded as a soldier to fight against the enemy, though his sovereign have right enough to punish his refusal with death, may nevertheless in many cases refuse without injustice, as when he substituteth a sufficient soldier in his place, for in this case he deserteth not the service of the Commonwealth, and there is allowance to be made for natural timorousness, not only to women of whom no such dangerous duty is expected, but also to men of feminine courage. When armies fight, there is on one side or both a running away, yet when they do it not out of treachery but fear, they are not esteemed to do it unjustly but dishonourably. For the same reason, to avoid battle is not injustice but cowardice. But he that enrolleth himself a soldier, or taketh impressed money, taketh away the excuse of a timorous nature, and is obliged not only to go to the battle, but also not to run from it without his captain's leave. And when the defence of the Commonwealth requireth at once the help of all that are able to bear arms, every one is obliged, because otherwise the institution of the Commonwealth, which they have not the purpose or courage to preserve, was in vain. To resist the sword of the Commonwealth in defence of another man, guilty or innocent, no man hath liberty, because such liberty takes away from the sovereign the means of protecting us, and is therefore destructive of the very essence of government. But in case a great many men together have already resisted the sovereign power unjustly, or committed some capital crime, for which every one of them expecteth death, whether have they not the liberty then to join together and assist and defend one another? Certainly they have, for they but defend their lives, which the guilty man may as well do as the innocent. There was indeed injustice in the first breach of their duty, their bearing of arms subsequent to it, though it be to maintain what they have done, is no new unjust act. And if it be only to defend their persons, it is not unjust at all. But the offer of pardon taketh from them, to whom it is offered, the plea of self-defence, and maketh their perseverance in assisting or defending the rest unlawful. The greatest liberty of subjects dependeth on the silence of the law. As for other liberties, they depend on the silence of the law. In cases where the sovereign has prescribed no rule, there the subject hath the liberty to do or forbear according to his own discretion, and therefore such liberty is in some places more and in some less, and in some times more, in other times less, according as they that have the sovereignty shall think most convenient. As, for example, there was a time when in England a man might enter into his own land and dispossess such as wrongfully possessed it by force, but in after times that liberty of forcible entry was taken away by a statute made by the king in Parliament. And in some places of the world men have the liberty of many wives, in other places such liberty is not allowed. If a subject have a controversy with his sovereign of debt or of right of possession of lands or goods, or concerning any service required at his hands, or concerning any penalty, corporal or pecuniary, grounded on a precedent law, he hath the same liberty to sue for his right as if it were against a subject, and before such judges as are appointed by the sovereign. For seeing the sovereign demandeth by force of a former law, and not by virtue of his power, he declareth thereby that he requireth no more than shall appear to be due by that law. The suit, therefore, is not contrary to the will of the sovereign, and consequently the subject hath the liberty to demand the hearing of his cause, and sentence, according to that law. But if he demand or take anything by pretence of his power, there lieth in that case no action of law, for all that is done by him in virtue of his power is done by the authority of every subject, and consequently he that brings an action against the sovereign brings it against himself. If a monarch or sovereign assembly grant a liberty to all or any of his subjects, which grant standing, he is disabled to provide for their safety, the grant is void, unless he directly renounce or transfer the sovereignty to another. For in that he might openly, if it had been his will and in plain terms, have renounced or transferred it and did not, it is to be understood it was not his will, but that the grant proceeded from ignorance of the repugnancy between such a liberty and the sovereign power, and therefore the sovereignty is still retained, and consequently all those powers which are necessary to the exercising thereof, such as are the power of war and peace, of judicature, of appointing officers and counsellors, of levying money and the rest named in the 18th chapter. In what cases subjects are absolved of their obedience to their sovereign? The obligation of subjects to the sovereign is understood to last as long and no longer than the power lasteth by which he is able to protect them. For the right men have by nature to protect themselves, when none else can protect them, can by no covenant be relinquished. The sovereignty is the soul of the commonwealth, which once departed from the body, the members do no more receive their motion from it. The end of obedience is protection, which wheresoever a man seeth it, either in his own or in another's sword, nature applieth his obedience to it and his endeavour to maintain it. And though sovereignty, in the intention of them that make it, be immortal, yet is it in its own nature not only subject to violent death by foreign war, but also through the ignorance and passions of men it hath in it, from the very institution, many seeds of a natural mortality by intestine discord. In case of captivity, if a subject be taken prisoner in war, or his person or his means of life be within the guards of the enemy, and hath his life and corporal liberty given him, on condition to be subject to the victor, he hath liberty to accept the condition, and having accepted it, is the subject of him that took him, because he had no other way to preserve himself. The case is the same if he be detained on the same terms in a foreign country. But if a man be held in prison or bonds, or is not trusted with the liberty of his body, he cannot be understood to be bound by covenant to subjection, and therefore may, if he can, make his escape by any means whatsoever. In case the sovereign cast off the government from himself and his heirs. If a monarch shall relinquish the sovereignty both for himself and his heirs, his subjects return to the absolute liberty of nature, because though nature may declare who are his sons and who are the nearest of his kin, yet it dependeth on his own will, as hath been said in the precedent chapter, who shall be his heir. If, therefore, he will have no heir, there is no sovereignty nor subjection. The case is the same if he die without known kindred and without declaration of his heir, for then there can no heir be known, and consequently no subjection be due. In case of banishment, if the sovereign banish his subject, during the banishment he is not subject, but he that is sent on a message or hath leave to travel is still subject, but it is by contract between sovereigns, not by virtue of the covenant of subjection. For whosoever entereth into another's dominion is subject to all the laws thereof, unless he have a privilege by the amity of the sovereigns or by special license. In case the sovereign render himself subject to another. If a monarch subdued by war render himself subject to the victor, his subjects are delivered from their former obligation and become obliged to the victor. But if he be held prisoner or have not the liberty of his own body, he is not understood to have given away the right of sovereignty, and therefore his subjects are obliged to yield obedience to the magistrates formerly placed, governing not in their own name but in his. For his right remaining, the question is only of the administration, that is to say, of the magistrates and officers, which, if he have not means to name, he is supposed to approve those which he himself had formerly appointed. Chapter 22. Of Systems, Subject, Political and Private. The diverse sorts of systems of people. Having spoken of the generation, form, and power of commonwealth, I am in order to speak next of the parts thereof, and first of systems which resemble the similar parts or muscles of a body natural. By systems I understand any numbers of men joined in one interest or one business, of which some are regular and some irregular. Regular are those where one man or assembly of men is constituted representative of the whole number. All other are irregular. Of regular, some are absolute and independent, subject to none but their own representative. Such are only commonwealths, of which I have spoken already in the five last precedent chapters. Others are dependent, that is to say, subordinate to some sovereign power, to which everyone, as also their representative, is subject. Of systems subordinate, some are political and some private. Political, otherwise called bodies politic, and persons in law, are those which are made by authority from the sovereign power of the commonwealth. Private are those which are constituted by subjects among themselves, or by authority from a stranger. For no authority derived from foreign power within the dominion of another is public there, but private. And of private systems, some are lawful, some unlawful. Lawful are those which are allowed by the commonwealth, all other are unlawful. Irregular systems are those which, having no representative, consist only in concourse of people, which, if not forbidden by the commonwealth, nor made on evil design, such as are conflux of people to markets or shows, or any other harmless end, are lawful. But when the intention is evil, or, if the number be considerable, unknown, they are unlawful. In all bodies politic, the power of the representative is limited. In bodies politic, the power of the representative is always limited, and that which prescribeth the limits thereof is the power sovereign. For power unlimited is absolute sovereignty, and the sovereign in every commonwealth is the absolute representative of all the subjects, and therefore no other can be representative of any part of them, but so far forth as he shall give leave. And to give leave to a body politic of subjects to have an absolute representative to all intents and purposes were to abandon the government of so much of the commonwealth and to divide the dominion contrary to their peace and defence, which the sovereign cannot be understood to do by any grant that does not plainly and directly discharge them of their subjection. For consequences of words are not the signs of his will, when other consequences are signs of the contrary, but rather signs of error and misreckoning, to which all mankind is too prone. The bounds of that power which is given to the representative of a body politic are to be taken notice of from two things. One is their writ or letters from the sovereign, the other is the law of the commonwealth. by letters patent, for though in the institution or acquisition of a commonwealth which is independent there needs no writing, because the power of the representative has there no other bounds, but such as are set out by the unwritten law of nature, yet in subordinate bodies there are such diversities of limitation necessary concerning their business, times, and places.